Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share she is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal series, including five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, Justine, and welcome, Rebecca. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Just fine. I've been working on my article for Plant Healer magazine today, and I thought I would start off by reading a little bit of that article. Plant Healer magazine is an online magazine, and if you haven't found it yet, you are in for a really good surprise. It is not only lively and interesting, it is beautiful, and their goal is to engage the most active herbalist in the United States to write for them, and they're doing a pretty good job of it, I must say. So do go and check out Plant Healer magazine. My series for them is about the medicine wheel, of plant uses. Sometimes I say, you know, that's a little bit of a lie because plants are used in many ways, and perhaps it would be better to say the medicine wheel of plant tastes. Well, I have been writing for them for over 2 years. And you would think at that point that we would have gotten somewhat beyond the East, but we haven't. We're still pretty much in the East, which is grains. We've completed that and then moving just slightly to the south of the East. We're moving into beans. Here's what I've written today. Pulse, pulse, pulsing, you who nourish life. Pulse, pulse, pulsing, you whose magic turns air into food. Pulse, pulse. Pulsing in my heartbeat, in my gut. Pulse, pulse, pulsing through my nerves between my legs. Pulse, pulse, pulsing. You who enhance the soil, you who beat in time. Pulse, pulse, pulsing. You who nurture animals, you who feed the bees, pulse, pulse, pulsing. You whose roots embrace the world, ground me, feed me, teach me, pulses, pulse in me. Laughing legumes, bountiful beans, roll me over in the clover and giggle me pink. The medicine wheel of plant uses turns, and we slide from grains to beans along the eastern arm of the wheel. Corn Mother passes us from her tender embrace into the lap of heavy-breasted Bean Mother. Then Squash Mother comes in to join her sisters. Relax and rest now. Drift into a daydream. Let yourself be languid and receptive. The three sisters share a cup of oat straw tea sweetened with clover honey. They continue their tasks. They are husking corn. They are shucking beans. They are hanging circles of squash to dry. They are telling a story. Shh. Long time ago, long before the two-leggeds walked on earth, there were terrible storms. Lashing rain and hurricanes of wind would gout from ebon clouds. Lightning flashed, thunder roared, waterfalls sprang over cliffs, and streams surged under enormous rocks, lifting them like tender babies from their cribs. But even long ago, just as now, storms pass, the sky clears and the sun shines. And even long ago, just as now, there may come a rainbow to mark the end of the storm. Remember, where the rainbow touches the ground is a sacred place. That spot is a place of magic and a place of wish fulfillment. So keep your eyes on the rainbow, children. Follow the rainbow path of peace. Long ago, but not so long ago that there were no animals, one of those rainbow arms touched down in some very high mountains, the ones we now call the Andes. It touched down in a high place, a beautiful place, a cold place, a stony place, a place where long-legged animals browsed. Now, this rainbow was a wide rainbow. It was a large rainbow. It was a fine rainbow. It was, in fact, a rainbow with ambition. And this rainbow stretched like no other rainbow has before or since. From one side of the sky to the other, this large, fine, ambitious rainbow stretched. It stretched, and it stretched, and it stretched until it found the perfect place for its other end. And its other end touched the earth in a low place, a fertile place, a lovely place. The other end of this big, beautiful, far-reaching rainbow came to ground in a low place, a hot place, a place of big cats and big birds and big flowers, the magnificent tropical basin deep in Mexico. And when the rainbow had both ends firmly on the ground, when the rainbow had placed both arms and both hands upon the mountains and in the basin, it began to dissolve. It gave itself away. It fell to earth in thousands of pieces. The rainbow fell to earth in colors, white, pink, red, yellow, orange, black, mottled, and more. The rainbow broke up into pieces, and every piece was a different color, and every piece fell to the ground and was welcomed into the earth. The colors did not fall on the ground like light. Light has no substance. The colors did not fall on the ground like water. Water keeps moving and changing. The colors did not fall on the ground like fire. Fire is jealous. It removes all competition. The colors fell on the ground in the form of substantial, reliable, cooperative seeds. The colors fell on the ground and became part of the earth. All the colors of the rainbow sprouted and took root and became beans. And the buzzing bees were happy. They kissed every rainbow bean flower they could find and made sweet honey. And the four-legged herds were happy. They praised the richness of their milk and the health of their children when they ate the rainbow bean plants. And most of all, the two-leggeds were happy. They felt full when beans were on the menu. And so they became fast friends, the two-leggeds and the beans. And they work together to benefit the whole community of life. So, what do you think? Did you like this story?
Yes, I did. I liked it a lot.
Good, me too. I'm a little pushed for time here, and it's always faster to write fiction.
Mm. Yeah.
Nonfiction, you're accountable for. Fiction, you just... Right. Nonfiction. It's just, woo, okay, good. Whatever we want. And let's see. I know we have some questions. I talked to Justine yesterday, and she said there were questions. And we also have a guest this evening at 9 o'clock, Rachel Berman. And you'll let us know if there's anybody on the phone who wants to talk, yeah?
Yes, there's nobody on hold right now that has a question, but we can go into the email questions if you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right. So first question, how, where, and when did you begin your journey with herbs? Did you always have a certain interest when around herbs and were curious as to what they could accomplish if worked with just a tiny bit? That's the whole question.
That's the whole question. Well, there were certainly not herbs in my household in terms of herbs used as medicine. There were some herbs used in cooking, but not a lot. You know, my mother's herb cupboard, it, you know, had the, pretty much the standard stuff, garlic salt, onion salt, parsley. It has a little, maybe a little dill seed or anise seed, rosemary or thyme. Really, no, not very much. I was attracted to nature. Nature was always a great friend to me. People seemed very unreliable to me. And being autistic, especially as a child, it was difficult for me to understand what was going on socially. And so I would retreat to the woods. When life just didn't seem right, I would pack a sandwich and get something to drink, and I would go off to the woods. Now, I was born at the very beginning of the baby boom, and lots of houses, of course, were being made for the returning veterans. And we lived in such a place where many houses had been made. But there was a little cliff at the end of our block. It was really a little cliff. We're talking maybe 3 feet. But it was just enough to stop the bulldozers. So my block, rather than going on into another block, ended at the end of the block in this cliff. And I could go down there, get down the cliff, and go out into a little woods, far less woods than Christopher Robin had to play in, maybe 5 acres of woods, maybe 10 acres of woods, really quite a small piece. But there was a little stream, and there was a bigger cliff, and there was a cave in the cliff where I could go and be. And nature always spoke to me. Now, on the other side of that little woods was the Dallas City Zoo. So I went to sleep as a child listening to the elephants and the tigers and the gorillas talk about it all night long. Goodness only knows what they were saying. So more I had a deep connection to nature and not to herbs at all. I left my home in Dallas to go to UCLA and to major in math, which is about as far away from herbs and plants as you can get. Although I lived in a sorority right across from one of the biggest, wildest areas on campus, an area so big and so wild that the house mother at our sorority forbid us to walk through there. Of course we did anyhow, but she was just terrified of this wild area. So somehow I've always managed to stay close to the wild, close to the plants. My specialty at college was artificial intelligence, but I gave it up to pursue natural intelligence. And I also found myself pregnant. I moved to Manhattan, 5 months pregnant, and like any pregnant woman, had a few minor complaints. I didn't want to take any drugs to deal with these complaints, but I wasn't exactly sure what else I could do. But I had heard someone mention herbs, and of course in the area where I was living in Manhattan, down on the Lower East Side, there were bodegas that were selling herbs. So they were starting to kind of come into my consciousness. And I went to the Manhattan Main Branch Public Library, you know, the one with the big stone steps and the lions. And I walked up there, and I walked in, and I said to the librarian, do you have any books on herbs? She got all 4 books that they had on herbs. Now, if I had read, say, French or German or Russian, I'm sure that they probably would have had more books than in English. As a matter of fact, at this point, I've written 5 books. I've written more than was available to me in the mid-60s. When I was first looking for information. Now, 3 of those books told me to put dill with my cucumbers and basil with my tomatoes. It's good advice. It was good advice then, and it's still good advice. It just wasn't the advice that I was looking for. So I didn't really even get involved in using herbs in any way except cooking. And I was using a lot of herbs in cooking. It soon became really clear to me that really the basic difference between food wasn't what was in the food, but the spices and herbs that were used to season the food. There seems to be, you know, a pretty solid set of things that people eat, but then it tastes different if you season it differently. So that really interested me, how I could make my food taste different with various plants. And I was especially interested, had a goal, as a matter of fact, to learn all the culinary herbs blindfolded, that I should be able to recognize them by smell and taste. And there was a man who'd moved to Manhattan, the Lower East Side. At this time, I'd now had my daughter, and so we're a little bit past the mid-60s. And his name was Pete, Pete's Herb and Spice Shop. And we really kind of spurred each other on. I would bring something I thought he might not know. And, you know, our first words to each other were, close your eyes, most of the time when we saw each other. And we would try to see if we could get something that the other one didn't know. So that was wonderful. I moved up to the country, and there I had my first garden. Made an attempt to grow basil to go with my tomatoes and dill to go with my cucumbers. But, of course, when those seeds sprouted, a whole bunch of other weed seeds that were in the ground sprouted too, and I just didn't know what to do. Fortunately for me, we had now gotten almost up into the 70s, and Ewell Gibbons was writing his wonderful books, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, The Healing Herbs, The Blue-Eyed Scallop, and he brought me to a recognition that the weeds that were growing in my garden were, in fact, herbs, and that they were as useful and in many instances more useful and as nutritious and almost all the time more nutritious than the plants I was trying to grow. My daughter's husband and I made a decision that we did not want to continue on together when she was about 4, and I found myself a single mom. I started looking for work, and it soon became clear to me that I was going to be going out to work to make money to pay another woman to take care of my child, and that I was going to miss all of my child's childhood. And that just didn't make any sense at all to me. So I decided I was going to be a stay-at-home mom, and since I didn't have anybody to go out to work and support me, I asked Uncle Sam to do it. I became a welfare mom. It's not a very easy life. We needed to scrimp and save, and wow, learning about herbs sure helped. It helped with our food bill, and soon it began to help with our medicine bill, too, and then it even helped us get shoes, because my daughter grew out of her shoes at a rapid rate, far more rapid than the small amount of money I was getting would pay for those shoes, and so I accepted a job teaching, and eventually I started teaching herbal medicine. Well, I guess to make a rather long story not much longer, here I am, still doing the same thing. Thanks for asking.
Wonderful story. We have a question from a caller.
Okay, so, let's talk.
In the 734 area code.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can.
Good.
Is this Susan Weed?
This is Susan Weed.
Oh, hello. My name's Michaela.
What can I help you with tonight?
Well, my friend Nancy is a big follower of yours, and she believes in you. I am 56. I've been working in allopathic medicine for some time, and I'm sick of it.
I work in allopathic medicine, too.
Pardon me?
I work in allopathic.
I work in family practice.
Uh-huh. Herbalists are allopaths. Chiropractors are allopaths. Acupuncturists are allopaths.
Mm-hmm.
There's only two ways to do medicine, allopathy and homeopathy.
Right.
I think
right.
what
well,
you mean is you work in modern Western medicine?
Correct.
Okay.
Where they prescribe a lot of medications and vaccines and refer people for all these tests, and I just got sick of it. And I became allergic to dust at my job.
Now, vaccines actually are homeopathic, so they're not allopathic medicine.
Right. All right. Well, so I don't want to talk about vaccines. I want to talk about me.
Okay, good. I've been hoping you would.
Right. So I quit my job in the early summer. because I was allergic to the environment. It was full of dust. And so I had some allergy testing done, and I'm very allergic to dust mites. And they refused to clean the clinic, so I quit. So I'm unemployed. I'm in menopause. I've had lots of losses. My mother died 3 years ago. A good friend of mine who's a straight doctor prescribed Prozac and Ativan for me, which I've not taken. I'm trying to walk 3 miles a day, but, you know, I'm just not feeling too good. Hello?
Okay. I'm right here. I wasn't sure if you were done. I didn't want to interrupt you. So do you have my book on menopause?
Yes.
Okay.
I take motherwort. I do nettles because I also have allergies. But
good.
The allergies
so how
are
you,
much better.
When you say you do nettles, how are you doing nettles?
Infusion.
Wonderful. So what kind of scale do you have?
What kind of scale? I don't know. I just like put a quarter cup of the herbs in with like
not an infusion.
Quart and a half of water.
Not an infusion.
Mm.
You have to have a scale. It's 1 ounce of dried herb. It's not a volume measurement.
Ah. So
in my book, it doesn't say anything about a quarter cup, does it?
No, I was just like winging it.
Okay. Well, you can wing it if you want to, or you can, you know, weigh it out and get the benefit.
Right.
I've been making infusions nightly for 30 years. I weigh it out every night.
Mm.
I would never wing it or eyeball it, but that's because I care about my health.
Well, I do too.
Well, then get a scale.
Okay.
You can get one at an office supply store.
Mm-hmm.
There's fairly inexpensive electronic scales, usually in the, you know, $20 to $25 range.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's too expensive, and since I was a welfare mom, I know, you know, that sometimes $20 can be a lot. There are also tiny little balance scales that I think cost
$2. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The electronic ones, you can get one with a T-A-R-E, a tear function. And then you, before you turn the scale on, you put your bowl on the scale and turn it on with a tear function, and it subtracts the weight of the bowl, and then you can just weigh the herb and not have to worry about doing math in your mind.
Okay, well, right.
Yeah, but
well,
in order to make
math.
An infusion, you need 1 ounce of herb.
Okay. So what about anxiety and depression, my friend?
And so you're putting that 1 ounce of herb into a quart jar and filling it up with boiling water.
Right.
I thought I heard you say something about a quart and a half.
I use canning jars, so they're a quart.
Good. Excellent. Okay, so we just need to weigh out of that nettle. Now,
mm-hmm.
I hear you being anxious to have herbs be prescribed like drugs, but I don't do that.
No, I don't want drugs.
Herbs are not drugs with green coats on.
Right.
If we're going to do something here, it's going to be about all of you, not just one little piece of you.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I'm starting with the nourishing herbal infusions.
Mm-hmm.
And you are drinking nettle as a nourishing herbal infusion. Which other nourishing herbal infusions are you drinking?
I do motherwort tincture.
Which other nourishing herbal infusions are you drinking?
Nothing.
Okay. So we want to have a rotation. We don't want to be drinking nettle every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And the least rotation that I think is beneficial is at least three to rotate through. I rotate mm-hmm. through stinging nettle, red clover, oat straw, mm-hmm. comfrey leaf, and linden. Let me tell you just a sentence or two about each one, and you'll have some idea of how they might be able to help you. Stinging nettle helps to rebuild the adrenals. It helps to relieve stress. It's especially helpful for people who are grieving.
Mm-hmm.
Oat straw helps to restore stability to the nervous system and to restore a joie de vivre, enjoyment of life on all levels. It makes all of all parts of us juicier, and of course it's a tremendous ally to the heart as well. Red clover is my go-to anti-cancer, cancer preventative herb. And we live in very cancer-prone times, and to me it's important to have an herb in my rotation that will help prevent cancer. And also, of course, it is rich in phytosterols, which can be utilized in the human body if there's good gut flora to create hormones and to help women feel strong and healthy for many, many years past their last period. Linden is a great favorite because it's an anti-inflammatory. And anyone who has any kind of health condition in which inflammation is a problem or is worried about any condition in which inflammation could be a problem, and that would include such obvious things as arthritis, but also atherosclerosis, which is inflammation of the blood vessels. It would also include, to me, anxiety and depression, because this is an inflammation of the nervous system, dementia, Alzheimer's, thyroid issues, cancer, a lot of things I really put in the inflammation place. And so linden is a tremendous help there. And then comfrey. Comfrey only strengthens and makes more flexible the bones, the ligaments, the tendons, the skin, and the mucous surfaces of the reproductive, respiratory, and digestive system. Oh, and one other thing. Comfrey contains special proteins that are good for short-term memory. Now, that said, you can use all five of those in a rotation, or you can choose three of them to use in a rotation. But I also want to remind you that you just told me that you are in menopause.
And my last period was like a year ago.
Do you remember back to when you were in puberty?
Yeah.
Did you feel good?
I had PMS.
Did you feel good?
No.
No.
I would
get through
get moody.
Did you get through puberty anyhow?
I got through puberty, yeah.
Guess what?
What?
You're not going to feel good during menopause, and you're going to get through it. What did you do to treat yourself for puberty?
I played softball.
You might want to take it up again. The fact of the matter is that menopause is no more of a disease than puberty is. I sometimes call menopause puberty prime. It is a time of great changes. It is a time when we feel uncomfortable in our bodies because our bodies are changing yet again. And we've gotten kind of used to the way our bodies are, and we're a little reluctant to have them change. Our sleeping patterns are changing. What we like to eat is changing. Our emotions are changing. And how we look is changing. It's an awful lot of change that's going on. For most women, there's difficulty in all of that change, and you're certainly not alone. For a great many women, the changes that go along with menopause include a change in status, with one or both parents dying during this time, and suddenly, oops, you're the elder of the family. Walking in to yourself as a baby crone, and yet many women have a really difficult time thinking of themselves as the crone because our culture doesn't necessarily make that something that we would want to strive for. So I am glad that you're taking Motherwort, and I'm glad that you're working with the Nourishing Herbal Infusions. And we're going to talk just a little bit more, because I would like to know a little bit more about about the kinds of things that you eat.
Well, I don't eat meat much.
That's a problem.
I'm a gardener, and so I, you know, grow my own vegetables.
And how well do you cook them?
I like them kind of crunchy, not raw.
Yeah, too bad. You're not getting any nutrition there. That's part of the reason you're not feeling good. There's no nutrition from vegetables that are just lightly steamed.
So you prefer raw?
No.
I think
you should be cooking your vegetables a whole lot more.
Oh, okay.
There's no nutrition from raw or partially cooked food. Nothing on this planet eats raw food.
Hmm. So what about dairy? You know, I can get raw milk.
That sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about vegetables when I say not raw. We're not talking about milk. Raw milk is fine.
So I should cook the vegetables.
Yes. Like, do you grow kale?
Yes.
Kale should be cooked for a minimum of an hour, better 2 hours.
Mm. Mm-mm.
And you really need to eat meat.
Mm.
You don't need to eat it every day. You certainly don't need to eat processed meat. But you do need to eat some meat because you're not feeling well. And this, to me, this is why I'm asking about your diet, because it's pretty clear to me that you're eating a deprived diet that's not providing the nutrition that you need.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I have a question. Okay, so stinging nettles, oat straw, red clover, linden. How do I balance all these infusions?
Do you eat rice?
Yes.
Do you eat corn?
Infrequently.
Do you eat oats?
Yes.
Do you eat kasha?
Infrequently.
How do you balance them?
It's not a cogent question, is it?
You don't have to balance them, do you? As a matter of fact, balance is the step that immediately precedes death. I avoid it as much as possible.
Mm.
I rotate through the infusions. Saturday we had linden. Sunday we had red clover. Yesterday we had nettle. Today we're having comfrey.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by a rotation, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Much in the same way that we eat.
Mm-hmm.
We don't eat the same thing every day, but we have a group of foods that we tend to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that this helps at this point. Get a scale, work with your nourishing herbal infusions, get some meat into your diet, get good quality meat, get some meat that's antibiotic-free and hormone-free, get some meat from a family farm.
Mm-hmm.
Really help farmers. Vegetarians don't help farmers, and vegetarians don't help animals. Be someone who loves animals. Be part of a group that I'm thinking of forming called MEAL, Meat-Eating Animal Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
You can really make a difference on a small family farm in America by eating meat. But you make no difference at all by being a vegetarian.
So one of my big issues is mood swings and just, you know, having lots
of anger.
I
really do understand, and I hope that you call back at another time when we can talk again.
Okay. So my time's
blessings.
Up, right?
Your time's up.
All right.
Green blessings. Night.
All right. Bye.
Okay, we have two more callers on here waiting to have their questions answered. So,
all right, let's have the first one.
In the 908 area code, you're
that
on.
That would be me. Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Hello, hi.
I can hear you.
Wonderful, and I can hear you too. I wanted to ask about... I have sleep apnea. It's soft tissue prolapse, and I really dislike that stupid machine they put me on. So I'm trying to do, like, singing exercises and so on to strengthen my throat muscles again to help strengthen, well, to prevent the prolapse that I'm sleeping. Now, I was learning about Collinsonia, cadensis stone root, and I know that it's good for tightening veins and it's an astringent. And it also has an affinity for the throat because they used to prescribe it or recommend it for preachers' throat. And I was wondering, I kind of made this leap, and I don't know if it makes sense, but I was wondering if stone root would be helpful in tightening, in assisting in tightening up the area in my throat where I'm getting the obstruction at night.
I'm certainly not an expert on sleep apnea. What I know about it is that for some reason, breathing becomes blocked while we're sleeping, and it causes the person to wake up, and often they don't even really realize that they have wakened, and in severe cases, they can waken as much as 40 or 50 times a minute. So they're really hardly getting any rest at all. It is usually laid to excess adipose tissues, that the fat tissues cause. What?
I'm not a big person.
Uh-huh. So.
I'm much smaller than most of the subjects they had for the sleep study.
Uh-huh. So did you have symptoms?
Oh, very much so. My husband would witness me not breathing, kind of choking in my sleep. So I actually went through the study, and I was waking repeatedly. It was pretty bad.
Yeah. And I haven't heard any particular thing about the tissues being relaxed, but usually that the tissues are in some way swollen. I don't think it would hurt you to take Collinsonia root, but I'm not sure that it's really getting at what's going on here. Did the doctor suggest that you elevate your head when sleeping?
They were very conventional in their approach. They notice that when I sleep, I move a lot, and I usually end up off the pillow. So any attempt at trying to raise myself usually is pretty futile.
What do you think is going on that you move so much when you sleep?
I've been a restless sleeper ever since I was a child. I don't know. I'm usually pretty relaxed. I take some herbs for helping me to sleep at night and to stay asleep. And I think it has to do with kind of like the sleeping dance with my husband. He moves, I kind of move in a response and so on.
Uh-huh.
And we sleep close, so that might be part of it.
I really hear you. So if he turns over, you turn over. If you turn over, he turns over.
Right.
So, is there any inflammation or swelling of the tissues?
No. What they said is that my breathing is fine when I'm on my side, but when I'm on my back, the tissue just kind of collapses down on itself. So I would think that means lack of tone. That's my assumption.
Uh-huh. I see. So that's not something they said. That's something you decided.
Well, when they said it was soft tissue prolapse and that it collapsed in on itself, to me it made sense from my thinking that it meant that the tissue in my throat wasn't as toned as it used to be. I used to be more active. I used to sing. And a lot of that started happening actually after had I known then. But that's another story. I had half of my thyroid removed years ago, and it was very hard for me to sing after that, so I stopped, and I think that there's a connection between then and now with my snoring.
Well, I definitely think that there's a connection there. I completely agree with you. The area where the thyroid was, I think that the tissues are kind of collapsing in too. I hear where you're going with the lack of tone, but I'm not so sure that I agree.
Okay.
I think, you know, we see this frequently. For instance, a woman, say, has a uterus that is prolapsing, and she says, well, we'll just take it out. But what happens when the uterus is out is now the bladder can just fall down in that area.
Right.
And then the bladder begins to prolapse, which is a much worse problem. So we're not just, you know, pieces and that we can take a piece away. When we do remove something, those tissues do collapse. So I'm wondering, you know, it's sounding like when you're on your side, you're fine. I'm working with you and your goal, which is to not use the machine.
Right.
And to see, you know, is there some way then that we can keep you on your side? And I hear that you are an active sleeper and that you move around a lot. But I find that our bodies are quite sensitive to messages that we give them. And that if you say to your body that you need to sleep on your side, you may find that your body will agree and will do that.
Okay.
Again, if you want to experiment with the colonsonia, I'm not against it. I'm not sure that it's going to have the effect that you're looking for, but I don't think you'll come to any harm if you experiment with it.
It was a leap, and I asked some of my teachers what they thought, and they never thought of the association. But considering where I am right now, I made that leap. But like you said, it may not help, but it's not going to hurt me.
Exactly.
I'll
call back.
That.
Call back in a month or two and let us know what happened. Okay?
I will. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you. Good night now. Green blessings. And did
okay,
you say there was another caller?
Yes. Let's open up the line for the next caller.
And what area code are they in?
It looks like they just dropped their call, actually, so...
Maybe they already answered their question. Sometimes happens.
Hello?
Oh, whoops.
Hello?
Not there.
Hello?
Are you waiting to answer a question, have a question answered?
Yes, I am.
Ah,
oh, okay.
Well, we can't tell when you're just saying hello.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It kept saying muted. I apologize. Hi, Susan. It's Colette from Long Island. How are you?
Just fine.
I'm calling one to say thank you so much for your suggestions concerning high blood pressure. I went to the doctor on Friday, and my blood pressure was 120 over 79. Which is an unbelievable drop in 5 months, and they're scratching their heads. And your suggestion of 20 minutes of meditation and passion flower tincture just did it. Woohoo!
Woohoo, huh?
Woohoo!
You know, and they can't get results that fast with their drugs, and the drugs mess you up.
I mean, they're just kind of stymied. They don't know what to say. But I'm just so very grateful. But I'm calling tonight with a question concerning the changing of the seasons and the changing, because I have a beautiful herb garden at my historic place of work that I was fortunate enough to plant. And I have wonderful things like Jerusalem artichoke and nettles and celerac and endive. And I was thinking about doing root preparation. And as I was listening to your previous callers, it seemed the subject was really all touching on the topic of inflammation. So my question to you is, now at the changing of the season, when so many people come to me when I'm giving tours of my historic sites, and they're saying, oh, my joints are aching or I'm feeling the change of the seasons, are there any roots or root preparations I can suggest for them that would help at this changing of the seasons?
It's a very interesting question. And I spent Sunday with my live-in apprentice and live-out apprentices and students digging roots.
And I'm so
and
sorry
we went out and we.
It.
Yeah, we went out and we talked about the roots that are available to us now, and we talked about the various things that they do, and we dug up some roots. We dug up some burdock roots, and we made burdock root vinegar, and we made burdock root tincture, and we dug up some dandelion roots, and we made burdock root tincture, and then we made burdock leaf and root vinegar, and we dug up some yellow dock, and made yellow dock tincture and yellow dock vinegar, and we dug up some chicory and we made some chicory tincture as well. And all of these roots are wonderful roots to be working with right now. The day before, Saturday, was our winter readiness class, and I didn't talk about roots at all in terms of winter readiness.
So when it comes to winter readiness, what would you suggest is one or two herbal go-tos that someone can say in general, these are your winter ready tinctures or herbal applications?
Well, elderberry tincture would certainly be one of them, wouldn't it? Elderberry tincture is such a useful plant. It helps to prevent flu. It helps to treat the flu. It helps to prevent colds. It's wonderful to relieve coughs. A real useful plant in many, many ways. I wouldn't want to go into the winter without some elderberry tincture on hand for myself. And then the other thing that I think about in terms of getting ready for winter is something that the goats have taught me. You know, when I was first keeping goats, and it would get to be this time of the year, and it could be a little cold at night, and I'd go out to the barn, and I'd staple up plastic over the windows of the barn, and the goats would promptly tear it off. And I watched them, and I began to realize that during this time of the year, they grow thicker, denser fur, and that if they're in a heated place, that never happens. They never get that thicker, denser fur, and then they're cold all winter. And then their immune system doesn't work right. And I think about how many people who say that they want to be ready for winter, and yet as soon as it gets the slightest bit cold, turn on the heat in their house and start wearing lots and lots of clothes, so their body never really acclimates to winter, and they're sick and cold all winter long.
So your suggestion is that we acclimatize ourselves before we start layering up.
That's exactly. I'm still walking around barefoot.
Woohoo! That's great.
I will be until there's snow on the ground. I want my body to know what the temperature is outside. Otherwise, how could it possibly respond? Similarly, if I eat all kinds of tropical fruits like oranges and bananas and papayas, how on earth is my body going to get ready for winter?
So with that statement, greater thing, more beneficial, that we eat with local seasonal available fruits? So it would be apples and maybe pears or things like that, what's available in our region at this time of the season.
Close. Apple sauce, apple butter, apple pie, pear cobbler, but not raw apple or raw pear.
And how about fermented? How about fermenting apple cider or pear cider?
Sure. If you can get it to ferment, in the state that I live in, New York State, it's illegal to sell cider unless it has a preservative in it, which prevents fermentation.
So if we made cider, homemade cider, whether we had a fruit juice.
You could make homemade cider and you could allow it to ferment, certainly.
And
you're still not getting you're not getting the nutrition that you get when you actually cook the fruit. But it's a pleasant thing to drink, and you're getting all that wonderful ferment.
And when it comes to, I still have beautiful green nettles. And, of course, they have beautiful clusters of seeds. Is that something that I should be using and preparing for the winter? Should I be tincturing the seeds or the leaves or the roots?
Tinctures are not a particularly good way to get the minerals from a plant, and nettle is very mineral-rich, so I personally have never made a tincture of nettle. Nettle seed is used in my green book, Healing Wise. I talk about the uses of nettle seed as well as the uses of nettle root and, of course, the part that is most frequently used, which is the spring harvested leaves. Any leaves that are harvested from nettle that has seeds on it are likely to do more harm than good.
All right. So at this point, if I was going to
point, you could harvest seeds and dry them and then use them in food.
Would this be also a good time to harvest and dry nettle and use it as a fertilizer for my springtime garden?
Yes, but I don't dry it. I harvest it, cut it up, and put it into 5-gallon plastic buckets, cover it with water, and let it rot. And then I use about a cup of that nettle rot and a gallon of water to water my plants.
And how happy are your plants with that?
Extremely happy.
I bet they're extremely happy. Is there anything that you may suggest? I'm thinking of doing a cold frame, an overwinter cold frame, to show different ways of growing things at all times of the year. Is there anything that you can suggest or would suggest as far as teaching that would be a good plant for a cold frame in a historic garden?
Well, I think that the usual crops that were overwintered were usually overwintered in root cellars. Again, I don't know where you live, but the area that I live, usually the snowfall is so heavy that you can't really do an outdoor thing like that. I've not ever been able to successfully overwinter kale, for instance.
Okay, we're in the east end of Long Island, so I guess it's a zone 7-8.
So I think that you're in a milder zone than I am and perhaps don't get as much snow as I do. But historically, you know, rather than to try to do that, most things were root cellared. So cabbages, beets, parsnips, turnips, rutabagas, carrots, leeks, onions, those kinds of things were grown during the good growing season and then harvested by now and put down in a root cellar to be kept all winter. If you don't harvest them, then you could certainly try leaving leeks in the ground. You could try leaving carrots and parsnips in the ground. The few times that I've left parsnips in the ground and the ground's been open enough to dig them in December, they have been incredibly sweet. I was very happy that I was able to get them there. Chickweed is a weed that hopefully will be growing in your cold frame, and I would certainly encourage it.
All right. And as far as if I was going to do chickweed, and would motherwort be a companion plant to chickweed? Would that be something that I could also grow to show, you know, medicinal plants that would be used year-round?
Motherwort's not used year-round.
Okay.
The flowering tops are harvested and tinctured.
All right.
The plant itself, although it's almost evergreen, tastes incredibly bitter. And so you could certainly grow it, but it would compare the size of it. It's rather like asking if a Great Dane would be a good companion to a miniature Chihuahua. Sure, if the Great Dane didn't step on the miniature Chihuahua, they'd be good companions, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got motherwort, you know, which can grow up to 4 feet tall, and chickweed, which gets about 3 inches tall.
3 inches tall. All right.
So to me, that's not a good companionship because you've got one big hulking plant that's going to take up all the light in the space and one little plant that's not going to get much.
So chickweed being being small and also a really good visual and a provider of nutrients during the winter months in a cold frame. And would I talk about how to put chickweed in a vinegar and how it would be used in different applications as far as topically and taken internally? Was it used topically for, you know?
Okay, so you're not going to get much nutrition out of your cold frame in the winter. It's not a place for nutrition.
Okay.
The nutrition is from your cold cellar.
Okay.
It's from your root crops that you've harvested and stored in the cellar. That's where you're going to get your nutrition. Your cold frame is for fun.
Yes. In education.
It's because you want something fresh and green, but you're not going to get nutrition from that.
May I ask you, do you have
you're
going to
harvest chickweed to make something, harvest the chickweed and make something. Don't harvest it from the cold frame.
All right.
I'm not following what you're saying. It just seems convoluted to me.
In the respect of, I guess,
If you want chickweed vinegar, which I can't imagine why anybody would, but if you want chickweed vinegar, make it now.
Okay.
Don't make it in the wintertime. It's not going to be good in the wintertime.
All right.
The chickweed going to survive the winter? No. It freezes up when there's a hard, really hard frost.
Well, I've been given a wonderful opportunity with this beautiful herb garden and being allowed to plant a historic herb garden. And when you're at a non-for-profit, there are many people who have suggestions, and sometimes you have the power to say yes, and sometimes the power to say no, and sometimes you just have to go with the program. So when it comes to an educational program where I would like to be able to convey year-round uses of healthy tonifying herbs, a board member says, we're going to have you do a cold frame because that's what they saw at Williamsburg. I guess the convoluted part is I'm grasping at straws as to what would be an appropriate herb that I could, because it's my job, that I can have as a teaching plant in a cold frame over the winter.
I've been trying for 10 minutes to tell you.
Okay.
But you keep throwing out these other things. The answer is parsley.
Oh, okay. And that would be tops, greens, everything of parsley, even the roots?
Yes. The roots used medicinally. You want the flat leaf parsley, not the curly leaf.
Okay. Well, then that's perfect.
There you go.
And I would now that's going to be how it was cooked in foods, and then the roots would have been tinctured or in vinegar.
The colonial housewives, so far as I know, didn't make tinctures.
Okay.
Do you have evidence otherwise?
I know that there were ointments made, and usually with animal fats and lard.
Ointment is different than a tincture.
Exactly. So I know.
I mean, they couldn't just go down to the store and get vodka. And if you look at the older herbals, you see that the doses are often given in wine glass fulls. So
yes.
Frequently what was done was that the herbs were made into wine, rather than being tinctured.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Or they were
yes,
soaked overnight in rum rather than being tinctured.
And that was your morning bitters. That was a part of your morning bitters. That was your toning herbs as your morning bitters. And those morning bitters were, you know, you'd have, it's like taking how people take handfuls of, you know, vitamins in the morning. They would have a rum with the soaked herb as their morning bitters, and they would have what was a jigger of rum, which I guess is about a shot glass of rum, maybe a little bit like a really big shot glass of rum, as their way of starting the day with their tinctured herbs and rum. You're absolutely correct. So that's a way of conveying it, and it's also a way of conveying to see how early people here who came Europeans, basically, thought that they were extending their life and their health by adding herbs to alcohol. But you're absolutely right. I can't find, at this point, I can't find any evidence of an actual tincture in anything I've read.
No, I haven't either.
That's very, very, that's very fascinating, because I know that I totally respect your breadth of study. And after all of my historic review, I can't find anything other than wine. And occasionally the beers seem to have quite a lot.
Beers as well. And so every apprentice group that lives with me has to make an herbal wine. And this is why. Because I want them to know how easy it is to make an herbal wine and to know that should all the liquor stores close, they can still get the alcohol-soluble parts of the plants simply by making a wine rather than by tincturing it.
That is absolutely fascinating, and I am signing up for your next time that you're going to teach that. That is a wonderful way. It's really such a beautiful way of showing a marriage of natural fermentation with something that's so simple that you've gathered, that you've collected, and there you are, and this is a healthful thing that's not just healthful, but it's enjoyable.
So
because
true. Sounds like you have a really wonderful job there in a glorious garden, and I hear that you get a cold frame because the board decided to get a cold frame. I completely understand. You're telling me, and that's fine. We'll just go along with that. And so, you know, the first year, you know, I would say, okay, you know, I'm going to plant some herbs, you know, that I knew the colonists had, and I'm going to see what grows. I'm going to see what thrives, right? Because we kind of have to test it out in that way. But the biennial root crops were sometimes overwintered in the soil, so those are possibilities. Carrots, parsnips, right? Parsley is great, you know, your chives, leeks, things like that, along that order, you'll also find will do well.
Well, I thank you so much for having such, you know, thank you for hearing through my own befuddlement of how am I going to navigate other people's intentions when I have my own desire of how to teach and how to express the knowledge that I have. And I really appreciate that. It's very hard.
And we appreciate you too. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Green blessings. Good night.
Bye bye.
All right. Next caller.
Oh, golly gee, that's
Are
our first hour.
Are you ready for another caller?
Yeah, ready for another caller.
Okay. Next caller in the 819 area code. You are on with Susan.
Hello, good evening, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. It's Monique calling from
this sounds a whole lot like Monique.
Well, I'm really thrilled to get the call in tonight. Thank you so much for being available. Over on our end here, we just lived a bout of the shingles. In my six-year-old Maggie's, it attained her left eye, around her left eye. And we've been home now for 10 days, but spent 10 days at the hospital to try to control or protect her eye before eyesight was lost. So she was on antiviral drip. For the 10 days solid, and so now we're home, and she's about to start school tomorrow. The itch is gone, the scabbing is still there, but a lot less, and her left eye is opening more and more, and we get her eyes tested now once a week, and it's not totally balanced out in terms of her left eye. Where the shingles were, sees a lot. The letters need to be a lot bigger than the right eye, but it's getting better. And we're doing cortisone eye drops right now, 4 times a day. We were at the point where it was at every hour until it started to settle down in her eye. And so I'm calling, please, for advice on how I can nourish everything that she's lived and how I can regain her strength food-wise and medicine-wise, herbal medicine-wise, because I just feel like we're now heading in that we've gone to the that one extreme and now we're traveling back to a more nourishing I'm at a loss now for words. I need help, please.
Okay. So, it's fairly rare to see shingles in a young child.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might want to ask, you know, what's going on, even that you would see shingles in someone this young. It's generally something that occurs in older people. Children tend to get chicken pox.
Yeah.
Rather,
and
which is
Maggie
the child's version of shingles.
Yeah,
secondly, at the very first sign of shingles, hypericum, St. John's wort, both externally and internally, will usually get rid of it very, very quickly. I was teaching a class about various herbs, including hypericum, and kind of right in the middle of the class, one of the students stood up and started screaming. I tell you the truth, this woman was kind of that way anyhow, and so we actually didn't pay a lot of attention to her. Just the fact that she was standing up and screaming until she started taking her clothes off, and then we definitely paid attention to her. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to believe in some kind of unseen devil, this would have been the time to believe in it, because she's pulling her shirt up and across her belly, from the midpoint of the belly around the rib cage, is this red mark, which is like pulsing, like somebody is whipping her with this invisible whip. And every time it pulses and gets red, she's like screaming, she's like, ah, it's on fire, it's on fire. Well, half the class was like terrified and wanting to run out the door, and the other half is like, whoa, I've never seen shingles actually coming out. This is fascinating. So I tossed her the bottle of hypericum oil from across the room where I was sitting, and I said, open it up and put it all over that. And she put hypericum oil all over it. And then I tossed her the bottle of hypericum tincture. I said, take a dropper full now and keep taking a dropper full every 20 to 30 minutes until the pain subsides. And then keep taking a dropper full. Oh, even every hour is not too much. She came back to class the next day, returned the oil to me, the hypericum oil, sometimes called St. John's wort. I call it St. John's wort. And the tincture. And told me that the entire episode was over in 3 days.
Yeah. We've been...
You have these remedies on hand.
Yes. And St. John's wort, I've been giving to her since the beginning, the tincture. I couldn't get the oil. The tincture I was doing every 2 hours. And I was not sure about the dose, so I was doing 15 drops. Then the oil, Maggie wouldn't let me come near her. And still right now she won't, with an oil, or she just doesn't want it to be touched. And I hear you on the
devil. How are you getting the cortisone cream in her eye?
Yeah. There you go. Well, at that moment, I'm going to do it. Okay. Yeah,
she
lies back. She lies back, and she accepts it. She lies back and opens her eyes and takes
accepts
it.
The cortisone, but she won't accept the hypericum.
Not in the oil form. No, we put on comfrey. I'm sorry, the French words are coming into my
yes,
head quicker
okay.
than me. The thicker ointments, the comfrey, the oil cooked in the beeswax, and that she's allowed. But I think with that, she was getting it in her eye.
I certainly would not bet. I would not put beeswax on it at all.
Okay, thank you. So the oil...
And so that's
fine.
What I would do now.
Okay.
Because remember, wherever we go out to, we just turn around and come back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we would have done at Or if we did do it and we didn't find that it worked, and then we go out to use drugs and so on, then as we're coming back, we come back, and then we use those herbs as we're coming back so that we come back to good health.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that you all are continuing to eat your good diet and drinking your nourishing herbal infusions, and
yes,
that she's drinking nourishing herbal infusions.
Yep,
and that's all good. Linden, of course, is a wonderful anti-inflammatory and well-liked by children.
That one we had at the hospital on hand, that was wonderful.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah. And it was great to get back to Nettle back at home and red
clover.
Yeah. Yeah. And
yeah.
I was wondering if comfrey tincture, I was going. Was there a healing in the skin that comes with comfrey?
Comfrey tincture is not.
I'm sorry. Comfrey infusion
internally.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something?
I was going to please correct. Comfrey infusion is what I meant to say, and not the tincture.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Comfrey infusion would be fine. It's not, you know, particularly for that. We're talking about eyesight. And, of course, with eyesight, we think of things that are bright in color. Tomato sauce, cooked sweet potatoes, cooked carrots, those are the kinds of foods that are particularly healing and nourishing for the eyes.
Great.
Dandelion greens, those kinds of things.
Okay. Super. Well, thank you.
You're doing a good job. It sure is hard being a mom.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I have the yeah. Yeah, but it's so, such a great pleasure to be able to pick up the phone and give you a call on a Tuesday night. I tried from the hospital, couldn't get through, drove me nuts. But I'm so thankful that I could get it through tonight. Thank you very much.
Okay, my love to you and your beautiful children.
Thank you very much. Love to you both also.
Okay, good night, Monique.
Good night.
Okay.
Okay.
Back to some email questions here.
Sure.
Okay. Can you recommend reference material for first-time parents to consult for herbal methods for dealing with childhood health problems? I have looked at Nature's Children and find some directions rather confusing. Example, under cough, it says to first determine the cause of the cough. I don't know how to determine this. Is there a reference for helping with simple diagnosis such as this?
I agree with you that some of the information in Nature's Children is kind of arcane and sometimes a little difficult to understand. And I think that what Juliet is talking about there is maybe a little simpler than what you might be imagining. What she's trying to say is there an infection? Is this cough because there's an infection in the sinuses or the throat or the lungs and we need to use something anti-infective? Or is this what's called a mechanical cough? In other words, there's some irritation, which is a non-infected irritation. Often you can hear the difference between the two kinds of coughs. Often a cough with infection will sound deeper and kind of rattly. Let's see if I can make that kind of cough. It's more like that kind of cough. Whereas a mechanical cough will be drier and shorter. It sounds more like so that's what Juliet is getting at. You don't want to just soothe the cough if there's infection, but you certainly don't need to treat an infection if it's just what we would call a mechanical cough. Children, of course, are developing their immune systems, and there's hundreds of different kinds of rhinoviruses, all of which give rise to slightly different symptoms, and the children are going to cycle through those things. Aviva Rom, R-O-M-M, has a wonderful herbal to help parents to use herbs for their children. And one of the things that we can remember and perhaps feel a little safer is that herbs aren't drugs. They aren't drugs with little green coats on. So, in fact, we don't have to be cautious so long as we are using nutritive or tonifying herbs. We don't have to worry about what's the dose or should I use this or not. So, for instance, if you really can't tell whether it's a mechanical cough or whether it's an infected cough, you could treat with something soothing. And if it's a mechanical cough, that soothing thing will usually make it go away. And if it doesn't go away, you can say, there must be some infection. I'm going to need to use some anti-infective herbs. So I hope that that helps, both looking into Aviva Rahm's book and having perhaps a little more of an understanding of what Juliet's getting at there. Thanks for asking. Green blessings.
So it looks like we have another caller here. So
okay.
In the, it says 111 area code.
Hello?
Yes, you're on with Susan.
Hi, how are you? I have a question for you. What herbs do you recommend to treat uterine fibroids?
Well, let me reiterate what I have said before. Herbs are not drugs with green coats on, and people are not collections of body parts that we treat. As a matter of fact, most of what we don't like about modern medicine is because we are drugged and we are treated simply as a compilation of parts. Down there, The Wise Woman Way, my newest book, has lots of information about fibroids. Fibroids, in fact, is such a common problem that it's also in my menopause book. And in down there, because I have put an awful lot of information into a fairly small space, I have help boxes. So we turn to uterine fibroids, which is on page 218. And the first thing that we learn is that recent findings from nearly a million counseling sessions suggest that 98% of hysterectomies for fibroids could have easily been avoided.
Yeah,
fibroids and the bleeding they cause is quite possibly the single leading cause for removal of the uterus in the United States. And it is an extreme reaction to a pretty common problem. In fact, every year, 250,000 women have a hysterectomy due to fibroids. About 80% of women with fibroids have no or very few symptoms. For those women, and often those fibroids are found on some kind of examination, what we say is do nothing. There is nothing that you need to do at all. It's appalling. I quote a doctor as saying that so many women don't have access to information about what to do about fibroids. Often the treatment they get depends on which door they walk through. Uterine fibroids, let's remember, are completely benign, sometimes called uterine tumors. They are not tumors. They are not cancerous. They are simply growths in the uterus, usually blood-filled growths. And between the ages of 35 to 50, about 20% of white women and 60% of women of color will have uterine fibroids by the age of 50. More than 80% of black women and 70% of white women will have fibroids. Well, you know, we got to like kind of sit back and say, wait a second. If the vast majority of women have something, is it abnormal? How can we define something that 80% of black women and 70% of white women are going to experience as abnormal? We simply make being a woman abnormal now, aren't we? Rather than saying, gee, the only fibroids that I would even consider a treatment for are fibroids that are actually causing the woman pain, actually causing bowel difficulty, causing bladder difficulties, or causing sexual difficulties. Women can relax about the big fibroids, says researcher Karen Hartman. Those are old and they're dormant. It's the little ones that they should probably worry about because they're the most active and the ones most likely to bleed. Women who have had four or more children or women who smoke cigarettes don't have fibroids. Isn't that funny?
Mm.
So here's our help box, and we'll get the fastest information here about what to do. Help, expect results within 6 to 18 months. First of all, take a dropperful of Vitex or Saw Palmetto tincture daily, 2 to 4 times a day. A dropperful, 2 to 4 times a day of Vitex, also known as Chaste Tree, or Saw Palmetto tincture. Two, investigate acupuncture. This is one of the few places where acupuncture seems to have some fairly good results. 3, listen to your uterus. Your uterus has something to say to you. There's a meditation in down there about listening to your uterus and another one in my menopause book. 4, drink nourishing herbal infusion, 2 to 3 quarts each of nettle and raspberry leaf on a weekly basis. And last, resist hysterectomy. Do not take.
I will. Okay.
Okay. And then there's 2, 4, 6, 8, about 9 more pages of information about
things that
we can do. Women who consume the most fish and leafy greens, including nourishing herbal infusions, are the least likely to have fibroids. That Vitek Chase Berry tincture that I was talking about, a drop or full taken 2 to 4 times a day, reduces uterine inflammation, changes the hormonal messages sent to the fibroids, eases pain, and helps shrink the fibroids. In German medical practice, Vitek is considered specific against the uterine bleeding caused by fibroids. Chase Berry works best when taken for a very long time. In Ayurveda, fibroids are primarily a pitta, liver, problem, and secondary a kapha, emotion, imbalance. Unfortunately, Ayurvedic practitioners use cleanses and complicated herbal formulas to treat fibroids. There's nothing wrong with taking a mixture of black cohosh, chasteberry, St. Joan's wort, wild yam, barberry, turmeric, dandelion, myrrh, valerian, fenugreek, cumin, ginger, yellow dock, fennel, and cinnamon, except of those herbs, the only one shown to actually against fibroids. When I'm taking an Ayurvedic view of fibroids, the simple solution that comes to my mind is motherwort. Its bitterness eases, and it's full of acceptance and self-love to help the kapha emotional issues. 5 to 10 drops of motherwort tincture or twice a day. Unfortunately, neither exercise nor weight loss will get rid of fibroids. Both, however, can moderate. So again, 9 more pages of information like that. I've given you the help box, and I've given you some more information about why you might want to consider using Vitek tincture. I hope that can help for you. How old are you right now? That was not intelligible to me. Did you want to share your age? Okay, perhaps I've been disconnected. Maybe you're on a cell phone and your call got dropped. You still there, Rebecca?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I'm not sure what happened to the woman we were talking to, but hopefully she's still able to hear, even if she's not able to speak to us.
Mm-hmm.
All right, who's next then?
No more callers right now, and it looks like we have about 6 minutes left. Do you want to try to answer another question from the email?
Yes, let's go to another email question.
Is red clover blossom infusion problematic for a person dealing with advanced stage breast cancer?
I could talk for easily several hours about red clover. And since we have only 5 or 6 minutes, I'm going to see how succinct I can make this. We often hear people talking about plants that contain estrogen, and we're told that they contain phytoestrogens. That is a bit of a misnomer. I do go into this in some detail in New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way. So if what I'm saying here isn't enough detail for you, please do look into a copy of New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and you'll find a really excellent and very thorough discussion of this. What these plants actually contain are phytosterols. And phytosterols are like the beginning forms of hormones. They aren't the hormones themselves. So red clover does not actually contain any estrogen. I have been told that at a rather prestigious website of people who should know, there's some quite misguided information about red clover saying that it is unsafe for any woman with breast cancer to use no herbalist that we have been able to talk to in the United States has posted that information, and there's no citation on it. The person who posted it, we're guessing, you know, works at this major hospital, but is not willing to put their name on it, so we really don't know where this information comes from. It's certainly not supported by any evidence of any kind. When we consume red clover, we are consuming these phytosterols. Now, phytosterols, or if you want to call them phytoestrogens, are so common that to avoid them, you would basically have to eat a diet that pretty much excluded all grains, all beans, all roots, all leaves, and all seeds. Well, that's just not really practical, is it? So we're kind of pointing the finger at red clover when it's not red clover at all. If we were going to avoid phytosterolic plants, we would have to avoid kelp, carrots, yams, potatoes, nuts, grains, beans, artichokes, blueberries, cranberries, apples, as you can see. It would just be absurd. Why is red clover getting that rap? Because it's such an effective and helpful herb. I know that sounds a little paranoid. Well, you know what? Sometimes I can be a little bit paranoid. The incipient hormones, the possible hormones in red clover, must be fermented by gut bacteria. If you generally eat things like yogurt, fermented foods, sauerkraut, and so on, then you probably have really good gut bacteria, and you're able to ferment that out. Let's look at one study that was done. It wasn't done with red clover, but as I believe I've established, red clover is not unique or different. It doesn't have a lot more of these compounds. It has pretty much the same amount as the regular foods that you're eating do. When we take women and feed them these foods that are rich in phytosterols, beans, grains, seaweed, so on, I read you the part of the list, and then measure their urine, there's a metabolic byproduct that is created when those phytosterols are actually turned into active hormones, and we can see that in the urine. And women who have more of that compound are much less likely to get cancer. As a matter of fact, if we give 100 women a food rich in phytosterols, and then we measure for this byproduct in their urine, the women who are producing the most byproduct, in other words, are converting the most of those phytosterols into active hormones, are 400% less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer than the 25 women excreting the least of that. What would you say? Is breast cancer a good option for someone who's dealing with breast cancer? As far as I'm concerned, unequivocally, yes. Red clover is a wonderful ally. I'm not worried about it being estrogenic and promoting the growth of cancer. Red clover itself is one of the world's great anti-cancer plants. Now, that said, are we saying that red clover could reverse metastatic cancer? It would take a miracle, but you know what? Miracles do occur. All right, we should be looking for Rachel calling in from area code 212. Is she on the line yet?
I'm not seeing her yet.
Okay, last week's special guest got her dates mixed up, and that's why she wasn't with us. We do send in the morning of the show, we do send out a reminder to our guests just as a courtesy so that they will be here and can get on the show.
But while we're waiting
for Rachel, you don't see her yet, right?
Yes, she's here now. She just arrived.
Wonderful. Okay. So we'll just move right into that part of the show. Thank you so much, Rebecca. We really appreciate you handling the switchboard there and getting the callers on and reading the questions. And thank you so much, Justine, for setting up the Blog Talk show and for taping that wonderful introduction each week and for helping Rebecca and I to do our best for all of the people who have questions. Thank you, Justine. Thank you, Rebecca. And welcome, Rachel Berman. Rachel
Hello.
Berman is the health editor at about.com. She provides users with practical, science-based information related to nutrition, weight loss, and health. Rachel Berman has worked with various patient populations in clinical settings for almost a decade and is passionate about helping people develop a healthier relationship with food. Mrs. Berman is the author of Boosting Your Metabolism for Dummies and The Mediterranean Diet for Dummies. And, you know, as somebody said, I don't like those books because they're written for dummies. And I said, well, you don't have to be a dummy to benefit from them. We are so excited to have Rachel Berman with us right now. Thank you, Rachel.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was a great introduction.
Yes, indeed. Now, you said that you work with a lot of different patient populations. Are there particular health problems that you see coming up over and over again?
Absolutely. I work with a lot of patients who are managing their weight. I actually work with a lot of young women who are suffering from disordered eating behavior nowadays, and I think that that's becoming more and more prevalent, unfortunately, you know, in our country as the standard of thinness is something that is, you know, painfully, you know, unachievable, and it's really impacting our young women and men. So that's definitely something I've seen. You know, it's not something that we really talk about as much. We're usually talking about, you know, disease prevention or weight loss, and the focus doesn't really shift over there as much. So it's something that, you know, I wanted to bring up that's interesting to me.
I'm so glad that you have brought that up. I was just reading that in one of the Indonesian countries, within 2 years of television being introduced, 30% of the teenage girls were anorexic.
Yes, yes. That's a very interesting study. They do a lot, you know, in cultures where there's not much exposure to the media, and then they see how that impacts women and men and their eating behavior, and also their thoughts, you know, just their thoughts around food and their feelings of their body image. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
So the obvious RX is turn off the TV and get your kids away from it.
Yeah, I definitely think parents have a big role in, you know, kids pick up eating behaviors as young as, you know, 2 years old, and they see what their parents are doing, even if it isn't explicit, even if it's not something you're telling your child, this is the good food to eat, this is the bad food to eat, so to speak. They're really picking up on what you're eating, how your behaviors around food are, and how your thoughts about your body weight are. So I think it's really important as a parent to set those, you know, set a good example early and to, you know, not obsess over the weight aspect about it when it comes to what you're eating, but more about someone's health, you know, someone's overall health and how this is going to help in the long run, really.
I think that's very confusing for people, partly because, you know, we kind of go through fads. We had this long fat, low fat, low fat, low fat, right? Eating fat makes you fat. Eat low fat, only to discover that, wow, fat is really important in the diet, especially important in the diet of women and children.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And
that, that's
in fact, you
right.
can't even lose weight on a low-fat diet.
Well, then you feel deprived all the time. You're always hungry. I mean, fat is one of the key nutrients that really makes us feel satisfied and full, you know, and that taste gives us a pleasure that satisfies us also mentally. So yeah, there's a lot there. I do think that we need to have a balance, though. I wouldn't, you know, like we're saying low fat is extreme now that we know that we need some sources of fat. It's just education is important to know what those, you know, the positive, you know, sources of fat are, like the heart-healthy, unsaturated fats that are really good for us.
It turns out that saturated fats are extremely good for the heart, too. Butter is one of the best fats for the heart, especially pasture butter, which contains vitamin K2, which literally protects against heart disease.
Sure. I know that there's a lot of studies on that. That's conflicting, but absolutely.
Yeah. No. There are people who claim that saturated fat leads to heart disease, but there actually aren't any studies showing that that's true.
Right. I understand. I've read that research.
Yeah. If you go back to the Framingham Heart Health Study, you're going to find that the people who lived the longest and had the less heart attacks were the people who ate the most saturated fat.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a combination of the other foods that are in your diet. I think that the key is that we can't just highlight one food as being good or bad for us. I think it's the sum of everything that we're doing, what we're eating, how we're exercising, how we're sleeping. It's really the whole picture.
Oh, Rachel Berman, that is such a brilliant statement. And it is so true. And people really want to, change one thing in their diet and have it change everything, but it just doesn't work that way, does it?
Definitely not. There's no magic pill, People just want, we're a society of quick fixes, right, of instant gratification. And unfortunately, that's not the case when it comes to lifestyle changes. It's boring for me to say this, but it's true. Making slow, steady changes really is the best way, eating right and exercising. I know it's not very sexy sounding, but it's... That's the best way to really improve your health.
Well, actually, it improves your sex life, too. It really is sexy. We just have to make it sexy.
True,
really heartwarming
very
story. A wonderful woman came to my week-long, very intense apprenticeship. And she considered, helping in the kitchen. Then she decided she didn't want to do that. But what she asked if she could do was, could she watch us in the kitchen? Now, I have a tiny kitchen. Many people's bathrooms are bigger than my kitchen. It's really tiny. So she actually had to stand in the other room and watch us. But she did. Every time we prepared a meal, she would stand there and watch us. And at the end of the week, she said, I could do that. I can make this food. And, of course, I give them all recipes. I do very simple things, and then they get recipes for how to do those. And she went home, and for the first time in over 25 years, she started cooking food for herself and her husband.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And within the year, between the two of them, they had lost over 50 pounds.
Wow, that's
heading
great.
Heading toward type 2 diabetes, not anymore.
Right.
And she said, this was so easy. Why did I think it was so complicated? She said, it's really easier than ordering food out. She said, because now whenever I want to eat, there's always some leftovers. There's always something cooked. Because this is one of the things that I tell people is you got to cook enough at any one time for two or three meals and then eat your leftovers.
Definitely. Cuts down on time also deciding what to order out, right?
Exactly.
You have it.
Exactly.
No worries.
Are there foods that you avoid?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Is there something that I avoid? That's a great question. I really am not, I like to be practical, especially like you said, you're teaching, others to be practical and making things in their home. I like to be practical whenever I'm speaking with clients or patients or the public about what foods to eat and how to incorporate them in your diet, because the truth of the matter is that, it's a socioeconomic issue. It's an access issue. I can't really go on, on air and really say you must eat all organic foods. While, there are some health benefits, obviously, of having foods that, might be organic, that having everything organic may not be realistic for somebody and in their price range. There's definitely...
Do you think it makes a difference? I don't. I don't think it makes much difference at all. And in fact, I say to people what's important is that you eat your leafy greens, and I don't care whether you get them organic or not.
Right. I mean, I'm not someone, I was just using that as one example of that. I don't really, while there are some pluses from nutritional, you know, some nutritional benefits, I think that it's important, like, to look at the diet as a whole. So me personally, I can't say that there's one food that I avoid, you know, junk food, or that I avoid fast food. I mean, I don't really eat much fast food, but at the same time, I see that there's a place and a time for it, if that's something, you know, that is realistic for you.
I avoid white flour products that have been enriched.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I really seriously avoid them, because what I feel in my body is that when I eat an enriched white flour product with B vitamins in it, that the B vitamin factory in my gut shuts off, and it's off for, like, days afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And so, in fact, I feel deficient in B vitamins when I eat something that contains synthetic B vitamins.
Right. That's interesting.
I've also been told by a great many people in the know that it is absolutely pointless and useless to drink skim milk or low-fat dairy products, that if you're going to drink dairy products, it should be full fat and nothing else.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of ask you that question because I know that a lot of kind of trained people have the idea that skim milk or low-fat milk is better than full-fat milk.
Was that, are you asking me a question? Do I think it's better?
Yeah.
I think that there are pros and cons. I don't think that there, I agree with you, I don't think that there's as much negativity. I think that the negativity around saturated fat has been, like, heightened and not necessary, you know, depending on where it's coming from. As far as, you know, the sum of your fats in the day, I definitely think that that needs to be kept under control, like everything else. So do I think one is better for you? I mean, personally, I can't eat that much dairy. That upsets my stomach, so I go for, like, a soy milk. But I'll eat whole milk. I'll drink whole milk. I'll eat whole yogurt. That's not something I avoid, or I say that you have to avoid. I think that it's nutritious. It has vitamin D. It has calcium. It has fats. It helps you absorb those vitamins that are fat soluble. So, you know, I do think that it has benefit as well.
Mm. One of the questions that you've given me to ask you is, should women avoid soy? So it's rather astonishing to hear you say that you are using a fake food, soy, fake milk.
Well, soy is not a fake food on its own.
But it doesn't have any breasts.
It doesn't have what?
Breasts. It does not have anything that lactates. It does not contain milk.
Right.
I'm saying fake soy milk. It's not milk. We can't call it milk.
I mean, not by the traditional standards, but it's not necessarily fake or artificial. I mean,
that doesn't have added calcium?
No, I use one that has added calcium.
Yeah, the vast majority of them have added calcium, and we know that women who use added calcium double their risk of a bone fracture.
Do we know that? I don't know that.
We
certainly
do. We've known that over and over again. The first studies were done over 30 years ago in Australia, showing very, very clearly that women who supplemented with any kind of calcium doubled their risk of a bone fracture. And most recently, within the past 3 years, we looked at the Nurses Home Health Study in the United States, and we found that nurses who were getting 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day from food and supplements were twice as likely to have a fracture as women who are getting only 800 milligrams of calcium a day from food alone, so long as none of that food was supplemented.
Okay. I mean, I think that I have a good
knowledge. Hi, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Justine. I just wanted to mention that the guest's audio is not working at all, hardly. I can barely hear anything she's saying. Are you on a cell phone or a portable phone, or is there something that you can do to adjust your sound?
I'm on a landline.
The voice is really very hard to hear. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to use the recording after. I mean, okay, for the live interview, but is there any adjustment that you can make on your telephone
Or is there another line that you can use?
The volume is up high, and I don't have another line, unfortunately.
Okay. Could you hang up and call back again, please?
Okay. Sure, I can try that.
Yeah. And you're in the 212, right? 681. Okay, I'll look for you and I'll unmute you as soon as you come in.
Okay.
Sorry about this, Susan. It's just
To me, she sounds like she's underwater.
Exactly, and it's getting progressively worse and worse and worse. So I just
know what to do about it.
Well, you couldn't do anything about it. That's why I interjected here.
Thank you. I appreciate your listening
in
and helping.
Let's hope when she calls back, the line will be a lot better.
Yeah, because she's got fascinating information. I'm really enjoying
hearing
what Rachel Berman has
to
say.
Archive the interview.
Yeah, and you can find Rachel at her website, which is rachelberman.com, RachelBerman, rachelberman.com, or you can also find her at about.com/health, www.about.com/health. And that website, About Health, arms you with the information you need to be an empowered patient and live your healthiest life. Its trusted guidance comes from writers who craft its contents, they're medical professionals and dedicated patient advocates, and they are approved by About.com Health's Medical Review Board. If you're trying to decide if you should take your child to the hospital, weighing thyroid treatment options, learning how to do yoga, whatever your health question is, About.com/health is there to help you, as is Rachel Berman. Do we have her back?
Yes, I'm just unmuting now.
Hello, is that better?
Hi, Rachel. Let's see if it turns out to be a little better. You there?
Hello?
Hi, yeah, that
Hi,
is
Rachel.
Much better.
Hi, better? Oh.
Wonderful.
Good.
Okay, great.
Oh.
Fantastic.
Okay, well,
that we weren't.
Okay. I'm going to get off now. I love you.
Okay,
Susan.
Love you too, honey.
Good night.
It's, you know, it goes in and out, Rachel, and I'm not sure if it's the distance that your voice is, that your mouth is from the telephone, but some of it's coming through clear and some of it is coming through kind of like you're underwater. Very interesting question you asked me. What proteins should people be sure to incorporate into their daily meals? Could you talk to us about that?
Hi, sure. I think that it's good to have a variety of proteins in your meals. I think that we should choose, animal proteins like meats, turkey. I'm a big fan of fish. I think that fish has those omega-3 fatty acids, which can help reduce inflammation and have other benefits, like they've been shown to reduce risk of depression and decreasing cognitive decline. And you can get a lot of bang for your buck with fish. You can actually typically have more for fewer calories than you would with other, animal-based proteins. So I'm a big fan of fish. And also, you get protein in things like beans, legumes, nuts and seeds, which also offer tons of antioxidants and other health benefits. So I think that could be a nice large variety. I don't think Americans are lacking in protein. We're certainly getting enough. But it's important I have a lot of clients who come to me and they're like just feeling lousy or don't have much energy and I look at their diet and really, sometimes, skimp on protein because they think they're supposed to be avoiding it or they're not sure what to have.
Interesting. And I'm especially interested in what you have to say about this because it has long seemed to me that protein is extremely critical in the human diet and that it's very difficult to get too much of it. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I encourage people to do is to eat plants that are very rich in protein.
Right.
Just as you're saying. Because those protein-rich plants increase the overall amount of protein without bringing in large amounts of fat or calories.
Absolutely. And grains, too. I mean, a lot of grains are rich in proteins. You know, like quinoa is one that's, like, really popular. It's all the rage right now. if to anyone talking about health might know what that is. So, you know, like, that's one that has a good amount of protein as well. So for people who choose not to eat animal-based, foods, or they're vegetarian, or they have ethical concerns, or any other reasons, that you can still get enough protein from it. Easy.
Oh, absolutely. And I certainly include grains and beans as plants, since they are indeed plants. But even things like amaranth greens are extremely rich in protein. And amaranth greens actually have all of the critical proteins that we need, all the critical amino acids. They're actually a complete protein, which is very unusual. For a green to actually provide us with that complete protein. The herbs that I'm most likely to suggest to people, stinging nettle, red clover, comfrey leaf, oat straw, these are herbs that I have chosen because they are so rich in protein. I really see all kinds of health benefits when people get more protein, so long as they're getting that protein, as you suggest, with the fish. Along with other antioxidants, those good quality omega-3 fatty acids. And so do you find that people have much resistance to eating fish?
Not really. I mean, I think that there's a lot, people are concerned if they, should eat fish or what kind of fish because of toxins that we've heard of and, risk of, during pregnancy or women of childbearing age. So I get a lot of questions surrounding that. I tend to, there are certain types of fish that, might be very high in toxins, but the truth of the matter is I think a lot of times the benefits of fish may outweigh the risks, and that I wouldn't necessarily discourage someone from having fish. There was a study recently that found that, we might be overdoing it with all this mercury talk, that we might be too stringent with our fish recommendations.
Yes, I had somebody tell me that she wouldn't dare eat fish anymore because they're all radioactive.
Right.
And I looked at her and I said, I've done my best to get to the bottom of this, and I'm not saying that there wasn't a really bad nuclear disaster in Japan. There was, but I just have not been able to find information telling me that all fish are radioactive now.
Right. I don't know that there is.
It's, I'm sure that you, like I, can get people saying things, and sometimes I'm not even really sure what to answer them. I had a woman here who was convinced that she couldn't handle gluten at all. And she actually went to the doctor and was tested for celiac disease, and the doctor could not find evidence of celiac disease. And her opinion was they just couldn't find it, that she did indeed have celiac disease. And she told me that if one of her roommates touched bread and then touched the doorknob, and she touched that doorknob, that she would have a terrible reaction. She was that sensitive to gluten.
Oh, wow.
And, I didn't know what to say because I thought, this is so, not true.
Yeah, I think with food allergies specifically, I mean, people, like we were talking about before, want to blame something for how they feel, just one thing. And if you're not documented by an allergist and you don't go there and the test doesn't prove this, then I think that it's something that, you have psychosomatic symptoms or, there's something else in your diet that you need to change. I think it's important to, if you do think that something is wrong, that you do really have an allergy, then go and get tested. And if not, try to figure out what else in your diet be the cause of if you're feeling, bloated or, like those are some of the symptoms that people with celiac might feel.
One of the things that I found is that we're not designed to think about our food. It's too much of a challenge. Our ancestors didn't think about their food beyond, is there any?
Right. Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely.
Yep.
No indigenous
yeah.
group in the world says, should I have strawberries or bananas this morning?
Yeah. It's whatever there
right?
was, whatever's available. Uh-huh.
So
we're people,
not
we're creatures of convenience, too.
About food. And I find more people in more trouble because they are thinking about food. And what I suggest to people is bring into your home only real food, nothing processed, and then eat whatever you want.
Right. But also pay attention to the reasons that you're eating. I mean, I think that oftentimes people, you know, may associate foods or as rewards or for other reasons other than they're hungry, right? So I think it's important also to think about the psychological reasons why you might be eating or not eating, for that matter.
Chocolate bar that I put right next to me that I told myself I couldn't have until I finished my taxes?
Right. yes, and no, I mean, I think that there's a time and a place for everything, but, you know, as I was alluding to before, I've worked a lot with you know, people who have very disordered relationships with food. So if it gets to a point where you're only eating as a reward or you're not eating, you know, for other reasons other than your physical feeling that you're hungry and you need to fuel your body, then that's something to reconsider and think about.
It certainly, certainly is. Well, we have almost talked our time away while you were dialing back in. I told them about your website, rachelberman.com, RachelBerman, rachelberman.com, and you can find out more about what Rachel is doing to help you develop a healthier relationship with your food. And you might be able to find out more about her books there as well. And then I also told them about, did I get this right, www.about.com/health?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's
okay.
A website where I manage all the health content, and you can find a lot there on a variety of conditions.
It sounded like a really excellent website.
Yeah,
so,
it is. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so now I hear that you are the one who is the editor there and making sure that the information there is information that's going to be usable, that's going to be practical. So I'd like to give you the last minute of the show. What do you want to leave people thinking about?
I want to leave people thinking about the whole shebang, right? Thinking about having a balance with what you're eating, not identifying something as the culprit for all of your health problems, and really just trying to be kind to yourself and true to who you are, and you know, choose mostly, you know, unprocessed foods like you were saying, but also being able to balance different nutrients and different foods in your diet.
That really sounds like an easy way to do it.
Much easier said than done.
Are you available to do one-on-one work with people?
I used to do a lot more of that. These days I've been, occupying my time with other ventures. But, you know, if anyone's interested, that kind of thing, they can contact me at my website. And, you know, if not me, I can find a really good person to do a one-on-one with.
Thank you, Rachel Berman. Thank you for being a woman who is making change. Thank you for helping us all to have a healthier relationship to food, and thank you for helping me here at Blog Talk Radio and Women's Radio reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again. Until the next time we meet, I'm wishing you green blessings. Bye-bye, everybody.